think the reason he lists for decades, has weaponized the occupation of Palestine and stood steadfast behind the Zionist project is because what the Palestinian movement represents and is Arab nationalism, the struggle to have control of your own resources, your own land. And that's why it's so crucial, just like they did in removing First Nation peoples when this country is being formed with the settler colonial genocide of around 12 million people, is the people for the project, the colonial project to succeed, you have to remove the people from the land.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. Gaza remains in the news every single day. And while we talk frequently about human rights violations there and different things that the Israeli military and government have done to carry out what amounts to really a genocide in Gaza, it still deserves to be at the very top of our minds. Well, we're recording this on Friday, the 7th of November, and I wanted to tell you about a call I received today. It was from a contact of mine in the Israeli government. He said something that was very interesting. He said that the Israeli government has reached out to private American companies to redevelop Gaza. Private American companies working with the Israeli government, not with Gaza Palestinians, to rebuild Gaza. I said to this contact of mine, what about the idea that the Israeli press is talking about, that Israel would own Gaza, but Saudi Arabia would administer it and would spend its own oil money there to create a port and an airport and hospitals and pave the roads and really get the place going? And he said, that's being discussed in the newspapers, but not by members of the Israeli military. So it looks like the fix is already in. We're going to talk about this and other issues related to Gaza with Seth Donnelly. Seth is a longtime activist, and even more important than being an activist, he's an author and the co-founder of Taxpayers Against Genocide. Seth, thanks so much for joining us. I'm tongue-tied here because there's so much to say and so little time to get it out. Thanks for being with us today.
Really good to be here, John. Really appreciate your program and your work.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate everything that you're doing. And, you know, the timing of this, Seth, is perfect because this is American taxpayers' money transferred to the Israeli government that is used to carry out this genocide in Gaza. Well, now it's time to start rebuilding. And it looks like the Israelis intend to lay ownership claim to everything in Gaza. What do we make of this?
Well, it's really what we're seeing unfold, as you were saying in your intro, is it's the ongoing extension of the genocide, and it's really the genocide in the service of ethnic cleansing, and to this sort of violent gentrification that's going to, you know, the Trump vision. Remember that ridiculous social media post he put out of that video. Can't remember if it was 6 months or, you know, I think it was about 6 months ago where it showed Gaza in the future, and he put it out on his forum, you know, so it was clearly absurd, but yet Trump put it out, and we should therefore take it seriously that it was showing Gaza in the future without Palestinians and with Trump and Netanyahu on the beach together. But, you know, it's the vision. We see a very similar thing playing out in other parts of the world, too. Like, for example, in Haiti, where there's a slow motion genocide happening under essentially a de facto occupation administered by the U.S. government and what's called the core group ever since the coup against President Aristide in 2004. And the objective is to remove the people and take over the resources. And so clearly that's in play in Gaza. And as you mentioned, it's our tax dollars that not only funded the bombs, but have also funded that are funding this reconstruction plan.
I've said a number of times that when I was stationed in Saudi Arabia in 1991, long time ago now, 1991, the Saudis told us that they had gone through a back channel to the Israelis and said that they wanted to develop Gaza. They wanted to build a seaport and an airport and a water desalination plant and an electrical grid, big ticket, multi-billion dollar items. And the Israelis said, absolutely not. This is when Hamas was so tiny that nobody was even paying attention to it. And the Israelis said, absolutely not. There was never any plan to develop Gaza. There was never any plan to allow Gaza Palestinians to have, you know, 24 hours a day of electricity or 24 hours a day of potable water. Why would it be different now?
Exactly. I mean, what Trump's so-called peace plan is, as many people have been saying, particularly Palestinian commentators, it's neo-colonial. It's a neo-colonial plan, right? The governance of Gaza will be turned over to what the media euphemistically calls Palestinian technocrats, but really the driving force is the international board that Trump has named himself and Tony Blair to oversee. So it's, you know, and then the U.S. is coming in to provide a command role with military presence in Israel to administer the peace, the quote unquote peacekeeping force that's supposed to roll out in phase two of the ceasefire, which of course hasn't happened yet. But in the meantime, every day practically people are being killed. Israel, per the plan, committed to bring in 600 trucks of aid per day. They're only bringing in at best 100. So they're only 1/6. It was just about a week ago that in a single day, they killed over 100 Palestinians, about half of whom were children. And, you know, it's an ongoing slow. At this point, they've ratcheted down from killing 100 people a day to an average, maybe, you know, more like 10 people a day. But the ongoing structures of starvation and deprivation remain in effect. So it's, to call this a ceasefire is itself somewhat Orwellian.
Well, and you know, that's an interesting thing because, yeah, here in the West, we're calling it a ceasefire. The Israelis call it more than a ceasefire. This is Israel's opportunity to you know, finally stomp out any remnants of resistance. I mentioned a minute ago that today is Friday. We're recording this on Friday, November 7th. This morning, the government of Kazakhstan announced that it was recognizing Israel and opening an embassy as part of the Abraham Accords. Nobody expected that. Not that it really means terribly much. The real cherry on top of the Abraham Accords for the Trump administration and for the Israelis, frankly, is going to be Saudi recognition of Israel. What do countries get? Saudi Arabia aside, what do countries get out of turning their backs on the Palestinians and recognizing Israel? What is in Kazakhstan's national interest that it would agree, for example, to do something like this?
Well, I can't speak to the specifics of Kazakhstan, but certainly we see the pressure that the Trump administration is putting on Central and East European countries. And there's a myriad of tactics and pressure points and incentives. We saw that when they were able to peel away like five or six additional countries to be abstentions in the recent vote against the blockade on Cuba, which were primarily Central and East European countries. That there are leverage. What that exact leverage points are in the case of Kazakhstan, I can't speak to, but certainly with Saudi Arabia, you know, I just read that the Crown Prince is coming to these states soon. And it's a way to further consolidate. Consolidate's the wrong verb because it's already fully consolidated over decades, the petrodollar agreement with Saudi Arabia and the weapons that they get from the U.S. But it deepens that relationship, you know, and clearly the Trump vision will be to have joint venture foreign investment partners, including the Saudis in Gaza, which is resource rich. And you know, it allows. I just read that Qatar had received a special protection agreement from the United States, and it goes beyond even what the Saudis have. So I think the Saudis are still looking to deepen their relationship, the monarchy, with the U.S. And of course, they fear their own population. The Palestinian struggle as they often say, the mainstream media hits a nerve on the Arab main streets throughout the Middle East. And these corrupt monarchies in neocolonial regimes know that, whether it's Sisi in Egypt or the crown prince in Egypt. So that their ultimate protection against their own population is the U.S.
So let me ask you a more direct question then. What does the U.S. get out of all this? What I understand the political desire of whoever happens to be in the White House wanting to support Israel, for better, for worse, in my view, mostly for worse. But what does the U.S. get out of all this? Why does the U.S. stand by and watch this genocide take place in Gaza and continue to support the Israelis to a level, to an extent, that just doesn't happen anywhere else on the planet?
Well, I still think that's you know, a key question that I wish was asked more, because in a lot of these discussions in the mainstream press, it doesn't ever get to this level. But there's that classic State Department memo that eventually got declassified. I think it was from 1948 that George Kennan authored. It was, I think, State Department memo. I forget the actual number on it. But Kennan, it's a famous State Department memo in which Kennan laid out internally the grand area planning post-World War II, that the regions of the world were essentially to be in service of the U.S. economy, and that the real threat to that extraction and those trade flows would be, you know, anti-colonial nationalist movements and governments. And of course, the U.S. would use the label communism to tar all those movements, you know, whether it's Mossadegh in Iran and Barbins in Guatemala or Lumumba in the Congo. Or I saw that your program recently on you know, that was discussing the drug, the Gary Webb and the Iran-Contra. And, you know, of course, the Sandinistas were a mix. They weren't just purely communist. But no matter who you were, I mean, it was Christians, it was radical-based theology folks that made up the FSL and government, along with some Marxists. But regardless, all movements that were nationalists were called communist. And so the reason the U.S. for decades has weaponized the occupation of Palestine and stood steadfast behind the Zionist project is because what the Palestinian movement represents and is Arab nationalism, the struggle to have control of your own resources, your own land. And that's why it's so crucial, just like they did in removing First Nation peoples when this country is being formed with the settler colonial genocide of around 12 million people, is the people for the project, the colonial project to succeed, you have to remove the people from the land. And so that's, we see to this day with this Abraham Accords, the so-called peace plan, an ongoing pressure. I mean, Israel still controls over half of Gaza, and this ongoing pressure to remove the Palestinians and crush the whole notion that the Middle East should belong to the people who live there.
Tell us a little bit about why aid is not making its way to Gaza, or why aid is only entering Gaza in a trickle. You said a minute ago that about 1/6 of what the Israelis have committed to is actually making its way in. We've already seen starvation in Gaza. Correct. That's been well documented. So aside from Israeli intransigence, is there a reason why aid isn't getting there?
Well, certainly the complicity of the U.S. and the U.S. and Egypt, you know, especially, you know, Egypt has been deeply, you know, complicit in the genocide. And so those points, like the Rafah crossing and the points coming into Gaza, if Egypt had stood up, and obviously if the U.S. had said no, we see that the U.S. really is the godfather of this genocide. So it really could have never needed, it could have been stopped in a day under the Biden administration. But Biden really was, even more than Trump, the Biden administration is culpable for what we've seen happen. But yeah, I mean, I think it's on that level, John, I think it's that simple. I think that without the complicity of the Egyptian U.S. governments, the aid would be reached. Now, the International Court of Justice, I think it was last week, just ruled that UNRWA the United Nations Relief Organization, that's the main relief organization operating in Palestine, has to be permitted to deliver the aid. And right away, Marco Rubio said, well, we're not going to allow UNRWA to function, as if the U.S., again, that kind of colonial mindset, the Monroe Doctrine mindset in Latin America being applied to the Middle East, as if the U.S. can dictate, you know, and just flaunt the International Court of Justice, which, of course, the U.S. thinks that they can. But that's where we come in as Taxpayers Against Genocide. I don't know if your listeners, and I don't want to, you know, take away the flow of the interview.
No. Go ahead and tell us. Lay it out.
Yeah, we're a grassroots movement of thousands of taxpayers across the country that realize that this engine of genocide could not function. The pistons could not keep pumping if it weren't for our money. And so, really, we're complicit. And the Nuremberg Principles established very clearly, you know, after World War II, when the Nazis and Japanese war criminals were put on trial, that ordinary people have a duty to resist, you know. And so, at a bare minimum, what we're doing is organizing a movement of taxpayers to both put our bodies on the line with you know, nonviolent protests and arms embargo work across the country, where we're following the leadership of groups like the Palestinian Youth Movement. But then we're also working with the National Lawyers Guild and the amazing attorney Huwaida Araf, who's one of the co-founders of the Flotilla Movement. And we filed with her leadership as the lead attorney. We filed the only international complaint in the world that systematically takes the U.S. to account for its driving role in this genocide. And that was filed, the most complete version of it was just filed last October 7th with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is the official body in the Americas that adjudicates abuses by human rights governments. It can't prosecute, unfortunately, but it's a stepping stone towards seeking prosecution. So we're encouraging folks, if you're watching this or listening to this, to get involved, because really it's the grassroots power, and especially as our power as taxpayers, that I think there's tremendous potential in this.
I want to talk about that in more depth in a moment, but you said something that's important I want to come back to. Let's talk for a minute about Egypt, because, you know, Egypt has kind of two faces in this conflict. On the one hand, Egypt is not just an Arab country. It's Umma Dunya, right? It's the mother of the earth. And every Egyptian school child knows that Egypt is Umma Dunya. And Egypt has 116 million people. It's a gigantic country. At the same time, it was the first Arab country to make peace with Israel, the Camp David Accords during the Carter presidency. And it's still a very poor country, where on the one hand, the Egyptian people, the average Egyptian on the street, wants to do something, anything, to help his Palestinian brothers. At the same time, you don't want the border open, because Palestinians are going to come into Egypt and take jobs that practically don't exist that Egyptians could take. So the Egyptians are of two minds over Rafah. Do they want Rafah open, or do they want Rafah closed? I think that the Egyptian government wants it closed. And in that respect, they're partnered with the Israelis. So what do you think we should expect from the Egyptian government? And Do you expect pressure from the Egyptian people to change the Egyptian government's policy on Gaza?
Well, certainly Egypt, you know, is the second largest after Israel, the second largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the world. The U.S. has decades of sustaining a neocolonial regime in Egypt, you know, first and foremost with Mubarak. And then the people did rise up, right, with the Tahrir Square uprising, emblematic of that, the Arab Spring. And then, you know, but then that uprising was not completed in terms of translating into a popular democratic revolutionary government. So instead, we have this new neocolonial regime that's quite repressive, led by General Sisi. So under his iron rule, we can't, to answer your question, we can't expect much from the government. If, you know, I heard a very strong analysis on this very question in an interview that Jeremy Scahill did recently, where he was, if I remember his argument correctly, and, you know, Jeremy Scahill is a really good journalist with Dropsite News, for your listeners, but Scahill was saying that the government of Egypt doesn't want to see, you know, a real opening, whether it's of the Rafah crossing or more. Really what he was saying is they don't want to see the Palestinian resistance succeed. But on the other hand, it's to the benefit that there's some ongoing conflict, that the resistance isn't completely exterminated, but it's just subordinate and weak, because then that also justifies Egypt's role to keep receiving large sums of military aid from the U.S. and sort of be a gatekeeper, right? So regardless of their motivations, their actions clearly show that they don't, when push comes to shove, they don't support the Palestinian cause. They don't play a reliable role, and they don't support the opening that could have saved, you know, who knows how many lives. A lot of folks on the global march there was a global march this last summer to Gaza, had to go to Egypt to then try to march into Gaza. And we had some very key taxpayers against genocide leaders that went on that. And the stories they had of the level of surveillance and repression by the Egyptian police was just, you know.
It was just a couple of years ago that Medea Benjamin went with a group from Code Pink, and the Egyptians literally broke her arm. I mean, Medea is a little tiny. I mean, maybe she's 90 or 95 pounds, but they physically broke her arm, arresting her just because she was trying to get to Rafah to escort a shipment of food into Gaza.
Yeah. And that's a perfect example. So this is the kind of regime that is a pillar, just like there was the Shah of Iran, and of course Israel and the Saudi. How quickly we're asked to have amnesia about Jamal Khashoggi, right? Like after being murdered and dismembered in the Saudi embassy, and the Crown Prince clearly being involved in that. Now he's supposedly a man of peace, and we're supposed to forget the genocide in Yemen, where the Saudi U.S. invasion just pummeled. At one point, the UN was saying that was the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, but you know. In Orwell's landscape, these things no longer exist. It's just the Abraham Accords and peace.
Listen, I spent my entire adult life either working on the Middle East or living in the Middle East. I was one of the CIA's leading experts on the Middle East, and I have just never understood this region-wide dislike of Palestinians. I spent much of my career in the Persian Gulf, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain for the most part, although I spent some time in the Emirates and in Qatar as well. And I never understood why there was this hatred for the Palestinians. I get that Yasser Arafat backed Saddam Hussein during the first Gulf War, but the Palestinians make up the entire middle class of these families. They are the bankers, the professors, the lawyers, the engineers, the teachers. They're the ones that make these economies run. And they're right. Arabs. And they're mostly Muslims. So I just don't understand why the rest of the countries, Egypt, I get it, because the Egyptians are poor and they're right on the border. I get it. But the rest of these countries, you would think, would be beating each other up to see who could do the most for the Palestinian people. And they're not.
Yeah.
And they never have been.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
But that's again where you peel away you pull away the curtain and you see the nature of these regimes, right? Whether it's King Hussein in Jordan or the Shah, and look at the United Arab Emirates, right? That this cozy relationship they have with the U.S. and they get tons of military aid from the U.S., which is indirectly completely fueling the genocide in Sudan. Right. So, you know, it's just like you can look at any region of the world. You can look at it, Africa, and you can look at why isn't there more Pan-African unity against, you know, in the post-World War II era. And it's, well, they come in and U.S. and say Belgium come in and murder Lumumba and then put in Mobutu.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about that, because you're involved. Yeah. You're not just involved in humanitarian outreach in Gaza. Taxpayers against genocide is against genocide, no matter where it happens to take place. So let's talk about Sudan. You've got the Saudis on one side of that fight and the Emiratis on another side of that fight, and the Americans supplying arms and materiel to both sides. You've got, you know, the essentially the lynching of Muammar Gaddafi back in, what was it, 2011. with the support of the United States, just at a time when Gaddafi was spending his money to develop sub-Saharan African countries and to spread the wealth in Africa. So what's the situation now, especially in the Sahel and in sub-Saharan Africa, in Sudan and South Sudan with these genocides? What can you tell us?
Well, what we can see, the big macro pattern is that the U.S. and its subordinate European allies in the West that have interests in, ongoing colonial interests like France, right, in the Sahel, that the project of the so-called Western powers is to maintain chaos and destabilization, which, even though that there's that favorite, that famous slogan that investment climate, that companies want a stable, quote unquote, stable investment climate, we've seen quite well that extraction and profits can be made in the midst of instability. What the West fears the most is a unified, popular power in Africa. And that's exactly what's happening right now in the Sahel, where we see countries uniting and nationalizing their resources and saying, sending the French companies and, getting off the French currency and whatnot, defying the dictates of the IMF. So it's a similar, very similar pattern to what we see in the Middle East, where the U.S. would rather work through neocolonial regimes, and if push comes to shove, if there's a threat of popular revolution or rebellion, like with the Palestinians, then it would rather rely upon violence and destabilization to maintain power than to see popular democratic unity. And that's clearly the case. That also explains why the U.S. Hasn't put a stop to its involvement in the slow motion genocide that's been happening in the Congo all these decades. It hasn't. It also shows why the U.S. was so hostile to the ANC. Actually collaborated and with the CIA was involved in supporting the jailing of Mandela. So it's a very similar pattern. And it's very on display too right now in Latin America with the attempts to reassert really violently through extrajudicial killings, illegal killings of the folks on these boats outside of Venezuela.
I want to ask you too about something that Donald Trump said a week ago. He said quite publicly on Truth Social that he's considering sending troops to Nigeria. Of all places, he alleged this mass killing of Christians. Now, there has been well-documented attacks against Christians in northern Nigeria attributed to Boko Haram, which is a Muslim terrorist group. There is Al-Qaeda in the Sahel that has attacked schools and churches. But there are also Muslims being killed in large numbers. In Nigeria, what's the situation in Nigeria? Are we looking at a genocide? Does this not meet the internationally agreed upon definition of a genocide? And do you think that Donald Trump is serious about sending combat troops to Nigeria?
Well, I'm just thinking on the very last question, if he's serious. I mean, one thing we've learned in Trump's second term is that, yes, he's a consummate grifter, but certain things he sends out as trial balloons or floats out there that seem insane, he actually has been implementing second term. So I don't know, but I don't think, the limited knowledge I have, and I need to study what's happening in Nigeria. But from what I understand, it's not even close to a genocide. I mean, it's actually a gross manipulation of the word genocide that he's doing. Just like they use this idea that there was a genocide in South Africa against white farmers. I mean, yeah, there's violence and then there's very real genocides like what we see happening in Sudan, just last week and beyond. And what we see happening in Palestine. And interesting enough, it never was brought up. There's a slow motion genocide happening in Haiti. It's absolutely horrific. There's now over 1.5 million people who've been displaced. There are relentless murders by what the U.S. media calls gangs to seem like it's not their responsibility. There are really death squads weaponized and working with the U.S. 9 times out of 10, they're working with the U.S.-backed regime and the U.S.-backed oligarchy in Haiti. who fund these paramilitaries. In any event, they turn everything upside down. So like they can take sporadic acts of violence that are very real and conflate those with genocide. And yet then they're seeing, we're seeing industrial scale slaughter of populations. And yet they completely fund that and weaponize that. And we're seeing systematic starvation of populations like in Gaza or Haiti. And they completely ignore that. So I know I've used this word a fair amount in this interview, but it's Orwellian. It's doublespeak. You know what we can expect. I don't know. You know, but yet the very real involvement. What comes closer to a real genocide in Nigeria in recent times was what was done against the Ogoni people, and when they set up the murder, the U.S.-backed military regime there set up the murder of Kinsera Wiwo for speaking out against how Shell and Chevron were destroying their land. Again, it's the land question. And the Ogoni people were nonviolently resisting in the 90s, saying, no, we want our land. We don't want it to be despoiled. The drilling is contaminating our waters. And the U.S.-backed military regime in Nigeria, you know, as some folks might remember if they lived through this, murdered some of the key activists under bogus trial. Now, the slaughter and the massacre of people and of the Ogoni people and the murder of their leaders, that's genocidal. But that was, again, with U.S. tax dollars.
I have a friend who is an eminent constitutional scholar here in Washington. He's a former deputy attorney general of the United States, and he represents the Karen people of Myanmar. He told me recently that Myanmar is the only country on earth that has been consistently at war since the start of World War II. It's not had one single day of peace since the beginning of World War II. It's the only country in the world that is in a situation like this. And it's all self-imposed, where there is a genocide against the Karen people, there's a genocide against this people and that people, and every different tribe that might want some kind of autonomy or quasi-autonomy in Myanmar is at war with the central government. Is this something that you lose sleep over? Is this something that you lobby the American government about?
I haven't been involved, nor has TAG at this point, been involved in the struggle on Myanmar and Burma. But certainly one of the things that both me personally, myself personally, and TAG is that, as you said earlier, even though the focal point of our work is solidarity with Palestine in this moment, we do make the connections. And ultimately, we're opposed to our tax dollars being used to fund genocide anywhere in the world and to sustain the U.S. empire at the expense of humanity, you know, the 800 military bases, the extraction of resources. We recognize, like, you know, Abby Martin just came up with this new documentary. Apparently, I'm eager to see it, but it's the greatest enemy of the earth, something about just the waste generated by the U.S. military machine and how it's destroying the planet. But we recognize these things. And so certainly down the road, I would like to make connections to the struggle. I know that I've been in actions and with folks who are part of the struggle in Myanmar here in solidarity with it, folks in diaspora. And it's something I'd like to learn more about and make sure that we connect those struggles.
I want to ask you, circling back to the Middle East for a minute, I want to ask you about the situation for Syria's Kurds. You know, it seems to me like just as the Kurds get to a point where they may win some autonomy, let's say, or rights within the country where they happen to live, be it Iraq or Turkey or Syria or Iran, or even, you know, there's a little slice of Armenia that has a sizable Kurdish minority. Just as they get to the point where things look like they may improve, they're slapped down again. And yeah, the United States more than once has turned its backs, its collective back, I should say, on the Kurdish people, especially Iraq's Kurds. What do you see as prospects for Syria's Kurds now that Bashar al-Assad is long gone? He's living in Moscow, and Syria has a new president supported by the United States.
Yeah.
Even though he is a former member of both al-Qaeda and ISIS, what does all this mean for Syria's Kurds?
Well, it can't be good, Right. Like one thing we, as you mentioned, one thing we've learned, if we study the history honestly, is that the U.S. has no commitment to the well-being of the Kurdish people. And in fact, it's the opposite. Not only did the U.S., as you mentioned, turn its collective back on the Kurds in the, you know, it said in the early 90s after the first Gulf War invasion, but then the U.S. supported Turkey, which was carrying out a violent war of annihilation against the Kurdish population throughout the 90s under Bill Clinton, right? Like, and NATO was, again, weaponizing this slaughter of the Kurdish people with our tax dollars. So to weaken Assad, the U.S. was, and to gain it, maintain, again, the chaos within Syria so that the U.S. could come in and do what it does with investments and military incursions, and Israel, which is obviously militarily involved in Syria. The U.S. supported, in a very limited way, Kurdish autonomy. But now that the objective of removing Assad is achieved, and now that we have this subservient government in power in Syria that is also linked up, you know, that has that, as you mentioned, the background of connections with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, I don't have any faith that the U.S. government will look after the well-being or the autonomy of the Kurdish people in Syria.
No, nor do
more
I.
Than, and we already see the regime carried out a slaughter of Alawite Christians, and PEEP came out of over 1,000+ people killed. And did the Trump administration once mention about Christian genocide in Syria? Absolutely not.
Yeah, between the Alawis are, well, actually Bashar al-Assad was an Alawite Muslim. And the Christian community, I mean, there are some estimates that put the Christian community in Syria at more than 5%. I've been to Syria. I went to an operating, practicing Jewish synagogue in Damascus. There's still a Jewish community in Damascus. But if I were a betting man, I would not bet money on the safety of Christians or Jews or Alawites or any other religious minority in Syria, not under this government or any other government. For all of his faults, and Bashar al-Assad was a monster. He was a monster. But for all of his faults, he at least protected religious minorities. And that's all out the window now. So, Seth, my last question for you is, well, it's my next to the last question. what do you lose sleep over these days? It seems like there's so much going on around the world. Very little of it is good. What bothers you the very most?
I think that really appreciate your questions. I think what bothers me the most is knowing that the source, you know, of course, there's many different levels and conflicting interests in the world that are involved in the abuses and that we've been discussing this morning. But there's a fundamental source coming out of the U.S. for so much of the world's strife. Like what Dr. Martin Luther King said in 67 still holds in the Riverside Church speech, where he came out against the Vietnam War, right? And he said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government. That is as true, if not more true today in the year 2025 as it was in 67. And so to see the continuity, I'm 55, so I'm to see the continuity when I was born, you know, and my parents were involved in the anti-Vietnam War activism, they were involved in the civil rights movement, but to see the continuity from the U.S. genocide in Vietnam to then when I was a young adult, the first invasion of Iraq, then the second invasion of Iraq. And so it's like this war machine is out of control, and it's over half our discretionary tax budget. And it's not just Trump, but it's this bipartisan consensus that the U.S. is above the international law. The U.S. refuses to sign onto the Rome Statute to be a member of the International Criminal Court. And now the Trump administration has even issued an executive order threatening people that cooperate with the International Criminal Court. So what I lose sleep over, what makes me want to grind my teeth, metaphorically speaking, is this impunity. And knowing that the source of so much of it is right here, within the U.S. So, but on the flip side, it confers a responsibility and a sense of hope that if we get better organized, the way we see other people throughout the world organizing, that we can have more of an impact than we might realize. But we have to be strategic in how we organize. We can't just, you know, tilt at windmills and feel like, you know, well, I sit on a corner again with a sign. I mean, that's great. I'm up for street protests, but we have to have a plan. We have to have strategy. We actually have to move this thing forward and envision a world without the U.S. empire.
Yeah. And where can people learn more about you and Taxpayers Against Genocide and the work that you're doing?
Well, our website's really easy to remember. It's just taxpayersagainstgenocide.org. And again, taxpayersagainstgenocide.org. And then folks can email us. I monitor the emails and so do other comrades, but certainly would love to hear from anybody who's found this, wants to get involved. We are still on our website. Folks will see the complaint that was filed with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, again, with the lead attorney, Huwaida Roth, and other amazing attorneys with the National Lawyers Guild, who authored that on our behalf and on behalf of Palestinian Americans petitioning against the U.S. government for the murder of their loved ones. So that complaint is on the website. There's ways how to get involved. We encourage everybody to join. We're trying to organize in regions. So we have, there's a tag group that's organizing in Texas. There's a tag group organizing in New York. There's folks in Ohio. There's, of course, out here in California. So wherever you are, again, that's the power. We need a mass movement of taxpayers to say no. And not everybody can practice tax resistance where you just don't pay. Because some people, obviously, if they might have kids or they can't afford to, you know, nobody wants to go to jail or prison, but not everybody, they just have people they depend upon, you know, that they can't do that. But everybody can come together as a class of taxpayers and organize for the accountability and the prosecution of U.S. officials.
There you go. Seth Donnelly, thanks so much for joining us. Seth is the co-founder of Taxpayers Against Genocide. And ladies and gentlemen, as a personal favor to me, I know I ask this every time, but I'm going to ask it again. Could you please like, subscribe, share, tell your friends about the show? It's because of people like you that we can bump that algorithm and get out there and spread the word. So thanks for that. And Seth, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John. Appreciate you.
All the best.